I want to take a break from the podcast right now, and I want to give you a gift. And I want to do that to thank you for being a listener. I put my heart and soul into this podcast. I love interviewing today's experts, researchers, MDs, psychologists, sleep trainers, you name it. I hope you feel inspired to take care of yourselves and your families. And I just want to thank you for being a listener and hanging out with me. So the code PODCAST10 is going to give you a one-time $10 off code at kellylevesque.com, your next order of protein powder. You can either use that on my grass-fed beef isolate protein or on my new vegan chocho bean protein. Now, here's what I love about my protein powders. It's 3 ingredients or less. So we don't use fillers, emulsifiers, no fortified vitamins or minerals. It's easy to digest and naturally made without any enzymes or chemicals like hexane. So it's 3 ingredients. With my grass-fed beef isolate, that's 100% grass-fed beef, and it's made in the way that you would make bone broth. So just heat and water. And we dehydrate that end product to get that collagen-rich protein powder that your whole family can drink. It can be added to coffees, to smoothies, and you can get it in vanilla, chocolate, and unflavored. I want to point out that my vanilla and chocolate is made with organic vanilla bean, organic cacao, and the only sweetener used is organic monk fruit. We don't use any maltodextrin. Our monk fruit is 100% ground monk fruit, and it's organic. And with my vegan line, I'm so excited to have launched this and to have it out into the world. It's a regenerative bean from South America called the chocho bean. And the chocho bean is the most superior plant-based protein powder you can get your hands on, because not only is it a complete protein, but the process is made with heat and water only. They're crushed and soaked, and what that end product results in is an anti-nutrient-free protein powder. So you're not gonna have any lectins, phytates, or oxalates in your protein powder. Makes it super easy to digest, and it's really, really delicious and robust in cooking as well. So I love it if I want a thicker smoothie or a smoothie bowl. And I also love it in my baked goods, from my cookies to my muffins, pancakes, and breads. It's the perfect protein addition. So if you want to give either of these proteins a try, or you've already been purchasing these proteins and want to take advantage of this special deal, the code PODCAST10 is going to get you $10 off for being a listener here at the Be Well by Kelly podcast. So head to kellylevesque.com or bewellbykelly.com. Put the protein you'd like to purchase in your cart and use the code PODCAST10 for $10 off. Thank you, thank you, thank you for tuning in. Joshua Fields Milburn and Ryan Nicodemus, known to their audience as the Minimalists, help more than 20 million people live meaningful lives with less through their website, books, podcasts, and films. They have been featured in the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Wall Street Journal, and Time Magazine. They have spoken at Harvard, Apple, and Google. They just released their 4th book, Love People, Use Things, Because the Opposite Never Works, which helps readers reevaluate the essential relationships in their lives to find more meaning and purpose. I am so excited to invite them on today to help us all release some of our material possessions and really lean in to the most important things in life, the people we love. Josh, Ryan, welcome to the show. I am so excited to have you. It's perfect timing post-pandemic and just deciding to live a minimal life. So thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks so much for having us. It's funny, you said perfect timing. And I think when it comes to minimalism, I think it's always perfect timing. I mean, it happens to be the pandemic why it's perfect timing right now. But, you know, when I started this journey 10 years ago, it was perfect timing.
You know, it's funny, Ryan, when you started the journey back then, we started asking this question, what is essential in my life? And now over the last, year and a half or so, that word has come up so frequently. We hear it, Kelly, we hear it with essential travel, right? We hear essential employees, essential businesses, but now they've been stuck at home a lot. They've spent a lot more time at home, at least. And they're looking around at all the stuff they've accumulated over their entire life. And they're saying, well, what is actually essential in my life? And they're realizing that, oh no, many of the things that I thought were essential, thought that were adding value to my life, they're masquerading as though they're essential, but they're actually getting in the way of what's truly important.
I love that. So beautifully and eloquently put too. It's your new book, Love People, Use Things, Because the Opposite Never Works, is out now. And that's why you're on the show today. But I think reading it and over the last week, it's just, it has solidified for me that I like fewer things. And I love the space that opens up for me. And you're exactly right. Like, what is essential and evaluating that for your life is so critical in having the space to really do what you love, yeah. build relationships with those you love, and live a really meaningful life. So you guys are the experts and you're here to get into the details. So can we start from the beginning? What is minimalism and how did you guys come in contact with this idea and start living a life centered around minimalism?
Well, the thing we say in the book is minimalism is the thing that gets us past the things so we can make room for life's most important things, which actually aren't things at all. I think you highlighted that when you were speaking a second ago. You were talking about how you're making room, right? Because here's the thing, decluttering doesn't work. I could give you a book about how to tidy up your house, and there's nothing wrong with that. We all want to have a tidier home, a more organized home, but the problem is organizing doesn't work. Decluttering doesn't work. If you own too much stuff and I hand you a book about the 67 ways to declutter your closet, is that really going to help you? Is your problem actually a shortage of decluttering tips? Or is the problem deeper than that? Our material possessions are a physical manifestation of what's going on inside us. So if we have a lot of clutter in our homes, like Ryan and I did a dozen years ago when we were sort of at the pinnacle of our corporate careers, you know, we grew up really poor, thought the reason we were so discontented growing up is because we didn't have enough stuff. And we didn't have enough money. And so we got some money in our 20s and we got a bunch of stuff in our 20s and got a bunch of debt getting that stuff. And it didn't make us happy. It often does the opposite. The objects of our desire become the objects of our discontent. And so we buy. And instead of it making us more joyous and happy and content, the opposite often happens. We're stressed out. We're overwhelmed. We're anxious. We're talking a lot about mental health these days, right? Well, maybe it starts with the stuff. Maybe by making room, by clearing the excess, by dealing with that, all that external clutter, we're able to look inward and start dealing with that mental clutter, that emotional clutter, that spiritual clutter, relationship clutter, career clutter, all these things that are going on inside us. And with minimalism, it really starts with the stuff, but that is just the first bite at the apple.
It's almost like bringing clarity to like a really heavy thing, which is it's really easy to buy things to try and make yourself feel better, keep things to hold on to memories and of good times. But if what you're saying is we need to live a life of minimalism so that we can reconnect with ourselves and reconnect with others and start to like really do the hard work on what we need to declutter emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, it's got to start somewhere though, right? I mean, if we want to live a minimalistic life, there has to be a process of declutter, right? Isn't that where we start?
Sure. I mean, I think the best place to start really is with this question. Anyone can ask themselves, how might my life be better with less? And when we ask that question, that is where we can kind of get to the root of why we want to start this journey. You talked about doing the hard work. And yes, minimalism, it is simple, but simple is not easy. Simple is very deliberate. It does take a lot of hard work. But the problem is that if you just start doing hard work and you don't know why you're doing it, then it may not be as meaningful for you or as beneficial for you. And, you know, I do want to say too, like minimalism, I know it sounds like this really radical lifestyle, but really the way Josh and I talk about it is it's a very practical lifestyle. I mean, you know, we're not monks. We don't just have bare white walls. But what we do is we just, you know, have everything in our life serves a purpose, what brings us joy. So for anyone listening to this, I just want to be very clear on this. Like minimalism is not this radical thing. Because here's the thing. If everyone stopped spending money right now in the economy would crash, right? It would topple. If we spend too much money, as we saw in 2008, the economy topples. And really this idea of minimalism, it's kind of, I think, that balance that at least that, you know, for Josh and I, it really helped us find that balance of spending too much, too little, having too much, having too little. But yeah, I think it starts with the stuff. But once you get rid of that stuff, really, you're just making room for life's most important things.
I love that. It's you talk about in the book, intentional purposes and those, like what you said earlier, essential purchases. So let's say, I would love to give people some tools after listening to this podcast. They're going to obviously be inspired to live this type of a lifestyle. I feel like I'm sure most of our listeners feel the minute I clean out a closet and take a break or even delete shopping apps from my phone, I feel lighter. I feel like I have space and I'm not being drawn to things that aren't truly important in my life. But you walk through this, the steps in the book of the first relationship being stuff. Like, how can we start to evaluate the stuff we have and evaluate our purchases to live a minimalistic life?
You know, when we wrote the book, we wanted it to be a traditional relationship book, but it's far from that. What we realized is, our relationships with people are often broken, damaged, destroyed by our other relationships. So how do we heal our relationship with our stuff? How do we heal these other relationships in our life? Because as Ryan illustrated a moment ago, right? We're not against stuff. Consumption is not the problem. Consumerism is the problem. What is consumerism? Consumerism is the ideology that buying things is going to make me happy, whole, or more complete. But the truth is, you're already enough. You were born complete. You have enough. Even in an empty room, you are complete. But in our culture, what do we always talk about? We talk about more, the pursuit of more. We never stop to consider less. And that's why Ryan asked you that question a moment ago. How might your life be better with less? Because understanding those benefits of simplifying, then if you understand that why, the how begins to take care of itself. Of course, as you mentioned, yes, there are some boundaries we can set up for ourselves. In the book, we call them 16 rules for living with less. We have these 16 different boundaries, really, that have helped Ryan and they've helped me establish a healthier relationship with our stuff. I'll give you an example of a couple of them. If you're overwhelmed, like the average person is, you know, the average American household has 300,000 items in it. It's a lot of stuff. And that'd be fine if it was all adding value to our lives and bringing us joy and contentment and peace, but it's doing the opposite. But we don't know that, well, the truth is some of the things actually do amplify our lives. They enhance our experience of life, but it's buried beneath all of this other materialistic clutter. And so one of those 16 rules that we have in the book is called the no junk rule. Everything you own can fit in one of three piles. It's either essential, it is non-essential, the value adding, that's a second category, or it is junk. Now, everyone has the same essential items for the most part. We all need food and shelter and clothing and communication and transportation and a vocation. All of these things are essential to us. And then we have these non-essential value-adding things. I'll give you an example. I have a couch in my living room, right? I have a dining room table in my kitchen. I could live without those things, but they add immense value to my life. And minimalism is not about deprivation. It's not deprivationism. It's minimalism. Maybe a better word for some folks would be intentionalism, especially if minimalism sounds too austere for you. Then intentionalism might work. Essentialism, identifying what does add value to my life. Unfortunately, there's a third category that most of our stuff belongs into, and that's junk. Those are the things that masquerade as important. We treat everything as though it's valuable. But of course, by definition, if everything's valuable, then nothing is valuable. I'll give you one other rule really quick. It's my personal favorite. It's called the spontaneous combustion rule. If you pick up any item in your home and you look at it and you say, okay, if this thing were to spontaneously combust right now, would I replace it or would I feel relieved? And if I'd feel relieved, then maybe that's the sign that it's time for me to let go.
I'm going to just walk around my house and hold things up and say, spontaneously combusted, how would I feel? It's true because we're constantly collecting things, being given things, purchasing things, and we're sort of drowning in things, it feels like. You talk about asking yourself 6 questions before buying anything. Or evaluating a purchase. Can you walk us through those?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So in the book, what we do is we identify, okay, you know, there are certain things we want to do to be intentional. Now, Ryan already started with, he started out by talking about some of the questions we want to ask ourselves about, like, how might my life be better with less? That's not really a how question. That is a why question, right? Because what we're really saying here is, why do I want to simplify my life? But then if I'm standing out the checkout line somewhere, well, and I don't know about you, but I quite often feel the impulse to buy something. Yeah, you know, especially if and it doesn't have to be the checkout line anymore, right? It could be Amazon. And so how do I create a little bit of friction between me and the next purchase? And so the first question is, who am I buying this for? Am I buying it for me? Or am I buying this to signal something, a consumerist equanimity about myself to others? Is that new thing for you? Or are you actually trying to project an image to others? And if it's truly for you, and it makes sense to purchase it, then by all means, go ahead, get the item. Like I said, let's not deprive ourselves of the things that are going to enhance our lives. The second question is, will this add value to my life? Man, we don't actually ask that question, do we? We buy things because we think we want it. It's called mimetic desire. We've adopted the desires of everyone else. We used to call it keeping up with the Joneses, right? Or now I guess it's keeping up with the Kardashians. It's keeping up with someone. Mm-hmm. But it's making us miserable. All this trying to keep up, all this competing. The third question is, can I afford it? And I don't just mean the price tag. You know, say you want to buy that new widget and it's $100. That's the price of it. But the true cost goes way beyond the price of the thing. The true cost is the cost of storing the thing and cleaning the thing and painting the thing and repurposing the thing, retooling the thing, putting batteries in the thing, changing the oil in the thing. And we're not even talking then about the psychological costs. What are the mental and emotional costs of owning these things in our life? The fourth question is this the best use of this money? So if I am going to spend that $100, and let's say I got the $100 cash, and it's burning a hole in my pocket, as my mom used to say to me. And fine, I'm going to use this money, but is this the best use of this money? Because money is a limited resource. I don't have unlimited money. I don't know about you, but I certainly don't. And so while I can spend this $100 here, maybe I can even afford all the other costs, is this the best use of that money? There's this great line in one of our favorite songs by a singer-songwriter named Andy Davis. And he says, the song's called Good Life. But he has this line where he says, we struggle to pay rent because jeans are expensive. And what a beautifully, I mean, if you sum up our book in one line, it might just be that, because we're reallocating money on things we think we need and forsaking the things that we actually need. Two more questions here. What's the actual cost? And so we talked about being able to afford a thing, but you know, what am I doing to the environment? What are the maintenance costs? What are the psychological costs? And finally, would the best version of me buy this thing? You know, I had this friend, her name's Leslie, and she was at a checkout line and she was picking up an item there. And it was just an impulse purchase. And she said she wanted to buy it. And then she thought, well, what would Josh do? She said, I guess he wouldn't buy it. She said, I need to get one of those WWJD bracelets, you know, that people used to wear in like the 90s. And just like, what would Joshua do? And it was fascinating because I need to ask myself that question, as in, what would the best version of me do? Would he or she make this one-click purchase? And if not, then, you know, just leaving it on the shelf is my future self letting go in advance.
It's really powerful because the friction that you're talking about, asking yourself these questions and reframing, like you're giving yourself six opportunities to say no to it. Whereas exactly what you just said, there's no friction when you're on an app on your phone and it takes one click to buy something.
Yeah. And if you say yes to it, don't you feel so much better about that purchase? Because you weren't just justifying the purchase mentally, but you've gone through a visceral exercise and you know in your viscera that this new thing is actually going to add value to your life. And how wonderful is that?
Definitely. It's informed consent. It's an informed decision. You've looked at the facts, you've evaluated it against yourself and your environment and what you really, really want, not what the world wants of you. And that's pretty powerful. The opposite seems to be true. And you've highlighted it in your book that we cling to things that we've had. Like, why are we doing that?
Oh man, I think we cling for a lot of reasons. I know for me, when I was going through my decluttering minimalism journey, a lot of it had to do with sentimentality. That was definitely one reason. It's, you know, I remember when I came across this box of letters that my mom had sent me in high school and, you know, a picture of like me and my prom date. And there was like a a whiskey glass, like a shot glass they gave us for our senior prom gift, which is really weird. They were giving 18-year-old a shot glass prom gift. But I'm like looking at this stuff and I'm like, oh, wow. Like I hadn't even looked at it until, you know, for years I hadn't looked at it. And it wasn't until I was going through my things and simplifying where I came across it. And I kind of had this like wave of emotion come over me and remembering some things, but I really just like, I just realized that I wasn't really getting value from those things. So for me, like, I just wanted to, you know, I'm a minimalist now. I got to get rid of stuff. I just wanted to like throw that shoebox away, but you know, I couldn't, like I was clinging to it. And I remember I was like, okay, I'm going to pick one thing out of this box. I'm going to let it go. And I'm going to see how I feel in the morning. And I remember I picked a letter that my mom had written me. And it's funny because the memory that I had with that letter before I read it, it was much different than like the emotion or the feeling that it invoked like after I read it. So me remembering it was different than actually experiencing it, if that makes any sense. So that was kind of like a first signal to me like, oh, wow, maybe this isn't as important as I am making it out to be. So I took a picture of it and I threw it in the trash. And I just remember thinking, all right, if I wake up in the morning and I absolutely can't get this off of my mind, I can grab it right back out of the trash and, you know, it won't be a big deal. I forgot all about it. I mean, it was days until I was like, oh yeah, that's right, that letter. So for me, like I went and I got that shoebox and I think I did probably take a couple pictures of things and I let it go. I threw it all away, or I should say I recycled it. And here's the thing is like our memories, they're not in our things. The memories are inside of us. Now, sometimes a thing can trigger a memory and that's totally okay, but I don't actually have to own that to trigger that memory. Now, does this mean that, you know, Josh and I are against sentimental items? Of course not. Kind of what Josh was saying earlier about things being precious. It's the same thing with sentimentality. If everything is sentimental in your home, then really nothing is sentimental. So I certainly do have a couple sentimental things in my home now. I've got like a Stein that my grandma gave me. She's from Germany and she got it from her hometown in Germany. And it was a gift to me. And it's something I put change in. And I really, you know, I get some sentimental feeling from that. And every time I put change in there, like I think of my grandma. So I'm only highlighting this because again, like Josh and I are not about not having things. We definitely want, you know, we want people to understand that it's okay to have sentimental items. It's okay to make purchases. The problem is that, well, like you were alluding to earlier, when we do it without any friction, it really can start to get out of control really quickly. And then no other reasons why we cling. Oh man, for me, the other thing that comes up is cost. Like I worked for a telecommunications company and I had all these phones, all these phones that like I would get. And you know, those phones were worth quite a bit of money at the time when they came out. And I just remember thinking like, man, I can't get rid of these phones because man, you know, I got $2,000 worth of phones. Let's say I had five phones that were, you know, $400 each. I got $2,000 worth of phones here. And then I realized, I'm like, well, wait a minute. Like I am never going to get $500 for a phone or $400 for a phone. That's 2 or 3 years old. So I really had to come to grips with something that Josh and I talk a lot about, which is sunk cost. There are certain costs in items that we just have to accept that they are sunk costs. So what did I do with those items? I didn't just, you know, recycle them. I did put them up on eBay, put them on Craigslist, and I tried to get $50 for them, $20 for them, and some of them sold for, you know, barely nothing compared to what I paid for or what it was worth, I should say, at the time. And then the other stuff, yeah, if it didn't sell within a certain amount of time, I would let that go. And I just kind of looked at it as a sunk cost because really for me to let go of items like that, that was much more valuable than me clinging to it and trying to tell myself, you know, some kind of story that one day this is going to be worth something or, you know, I can't get rid of it until I get back, you know, what I put into this item. I had a plasma TV. I ended up selling it for like 80, it was like a, you know, 40 inch, 50 inch plasma TV. I ended up selling it for less than $100. I think I paid, you know, $1,000 for that thing. But I'll tell you, hey, getting that out of my home, again, that was great. But the people I sold it to, it was this like young couple who just moved into their first apartment together. And like, they were so excited to get this TV for like, I think it was $90 is what I sold it for. And like that, the joy that I was able to experience from like helping out this young couple who was just starting out on their own, it really felt good. So, you know, not only can someone kind of look at the sunk cost of an item to help them get rid of things, but also the items that we're not using that aren't adding value to us right now. There might be someone out there who those items could add some value to. So, you know, those are just a couple examples of reasons why I would cling, but certainly when we do things deliberately and come at it from a bit of a different approach, it's our grip gets a little looser.
You mentioned that you weren't using those phones right now, but what if you use them? And the television, obviously, it had a major cost. Can we talk a little bit about like the what ifs, the just in case, that whole piece of this puzzle, which is anytime anyone's tried to like release themselves and rid themselves of like possessions to lighten their load, there's always this what if, just in case, but I might use that eventually. can you walk us through how you might coach your community or people who follow you to work through that?
Oh yeah. You know, just in case, they might be the three most dangerous words in the English language when strung together like that. Because yes, I think we can almost justify about anything. And I'll tell you, the first time it really hit me with the just in case items. So Josh and I, we simplified, we put our story online. We wrote a book and we were going to go on this book tour. And the very first city that we went to, it was St. Petersburg, Florida. We open up the trunk to the car and we're like, you know, bringing our stuff into the hotel. And I'm looking at the trunk and I'm like, dude, we are hypocrites, man. Like we were only gone for like 2 weeks. We each had like two bags. I think Josh had like a garment bag with like a suit in there for whatever reason.
And emergency funeral.
Right.
Just in case.
And you know, and it hit me like when we were talking about why did we pack so many things, it started to become very clear that it was all of these just in case items. Well, we're going to be in Florida, so I'm going to bring a pair of swimming trunks. And you know what? Maybe those swimming trunks will get dirty and I won't have a washing machine. And I'm going to bring a second pair of swimming trunks just in case. And there were all these just in case items. So Josh and I, we actually, that's one of the rules that we talk about in Love People Use Things. It is the just in case rule, or it's known as the 2020 rule. And the reasons why it's known as the 2020 rule is because what we realized is that all of the just in case items that we were holding onto, we could replace any just in case item for less than $20 in less than 20 minutes. Now, I know that in the beginning, that kind of sounds like maybe a rule of privilege. You know, no one wants to spend $20 a day on just in case items. But the beautiful thing about it is you never have to use it. I mean, Josh and I, we have been using this rule for the last 10 years. We lived in the middle of nowhere, Montana. There was one traffic light in 1,500 square miles in this town that we lived in. And even that just in case rule, it worked even out there in the middle of nowhere, Montana. I mean, I think between the both of us, we might have had to have used it over the last 10 years, maybe five times, maybe six times. So the just in case items, yes, we can justify anything. The other thing that comes to mind for the just in case items are all the charging cables and the USB cables and the Ethernet cables. I mean, that was some of my biggest just in case items. Like I had this box just full of random cables. And again, looking at that, I'm like, man, I can replace any of these for less than $20 in less than 20 minutes. And you know, that rule has just given me permission to let go of thousands of just in case items.
When we did Ryan's packing party, there was this, which we talk about in the book, where he boxed up everything, pretended like he was moving. That's the one time everyone is sort of forced to confront their stuff, right? He had seven junk drawers. So think about this for a second. What is in a junk drawer? It's the ultimate just in case. It's a portal for our just in case items. It's a mausoleum, actually, for just in case items. And usually what we do when we have a junk drawer is if it becomes full, we empty it out. Ryan was like, well, I've got this one full. We'll start another one.
Yeah.
And guess what? We do that throughout all of our homes. At least he was being honest and calling them junk drawers. Sometimes, what do we call it? Sentimental items and collections. I mean, collecting is really just well-planned hoarding when you think about it. Now, don't get me wrong. There are professional collectors and curators. You think about a museum. They have a collection of artwork. And so we're not talking about that. And if you truly get value from a collection, Ryan and I aren't here to say, bah, humbug, get rid of it. you're wrong. There is no right or wrong here. If it's making you miserable though, then maybe that's a sign to let go.
It's interesting because you make the comparison to museum, where a collection is on display. It isn't overly cluttered. It's a very open space with perfectly curated things on the walls that make you feel calm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I love going to museums, and I'm really glad that there are professional curators out there. And it's funny because as you were describing that, Kelly, it made me think about how in museums, it's almost like the painting is a piece of it for sure. But the space, the walls, the architecture, like the Getty Museum in LA is like one of my favorite museums. And it has everything to do with the architecture. And then the paintings is kind of like it's like an added bonus in a way.
It creates that experience because the funny thing about the Getty is you can actually go on the Getty's website and see all of their paintings.
Mm.
But it's not the same thing. It's not even close to the same thing. I was really frustrated when my favorite photography museum closed during COVID last year, the Annenberg Center for Photography. Ryan had been out there with me at least once or twice. We used to bring our daughter out there. And what was really nice about that, not our daughter, Ryan, I don't have a daughter.
Wait a minute.
My wife
and
I.
We have a daughter?
Yeah. You can borrow her.
Okay, great.
I'm happy to lend you.
Uncle Ryan.
Anyway, we used to go out there all the time, and it was a small museum. And so they had to be very intentional about what photography they placed out, because let's say they had 150 photos on display at any one time and it was gorgeous. It was curated. I got immense value from it. But now imagine if they doubled that, tripled it, quadrupled it. What would happen? Oh, well, it would turn that beautiful experience into a bit of a nightmare. And yet that's what we're doing with our homes right now. All those things that do augment our life, they're crammed in with all the things that sort of spoil the things.
No, and I loved how you explained, Ryan, how you went to Ryan's house and you packed up his house as if he was moving. Because moving is like, well, I've moved a couple of times, once in the pandemic, but and I'll move again twice in the pandemic and I'll move again. But moving is one of the greatest gifts, because you are able to identify what is not essential, how to curate and create that feeling of walking into the Annenberg space for photography or a museum in your own home. Like what a gift you can give yourself and your family. I'm curious, when it came to packing up your house, Ryan, were there things that you were surprised you didn't keep?
Oh, for sure. I mean, so just for the listeners who haven't heard of the packing party, real briefly, like when Josh and I first started the whole minimalism journey, Josh really started first and he introduced me to minimalism. And I was really excited about being a minimalist, but I had no idea where to start. I'm like, great, I'm a minimalist. Wait, what do I do now? So we came up with this idea of a packing party where we decided to pack up all my belongings as if I were moving. And then I would unpack only the items I needed over the next 3 weeks. So this was a 21-day experiment. Josh came over. He helped me pack up everything. My clothes, my kitchenware, my towels, my TVs, my electronics, my framed photographs and paintings, my toiletries. I mean, even my furniture, everything. We pretended like I was moving. So yes, when I was done with that 21-day experiment, I was blown away by, looking at 80% of my stuff still sitting in those boxes, just sitting there unaccessed. It's like I had this, this revelation of like, wow, here are all these things I brought into my life to make me happy, but they're not really doing their job. And yeah, I was shocked by some of the furniture I never used. I was shocked by some of the sentimental stuff I had sitting around that, I didn't even miss. I was very shocked that just 80% of my stuff was still in those boxes. But it's really where the minimalists.com started. It was with that packing party story. I decided to donate, to sell, to recycle all of it. And the rest is history.
We did a reenactment of the packing party on our last Netflix film. We have a couple documentaries up on Netflix. First one was called Minimalism. The second one's called Less Is Now. And in Less Is Now, we did a sort of recreation of that where we boxed up everything in a house that looked a lot like Ryan's condo and sort of recreated that. But we had seen it work and we'd heard some anecdotes about it. And we wanted to find out whether or not that was appropriate for other people. So in Love People Use Things, the new book, we had 47 families and individuals do a version of the packing party with us. There were sort of three options they had. They could do what Ryan did, jump all the way in, head first into the deep end, and pack up their whole house, pretend like they're moving, even cover up the furniture, everything. Or they could just do one room if they just wanted to start small, start somewhere. You've got that spare bedroom or you've got that bathroom or whatever, doing that packing party in just one room and seeing what adds value in there and then moving on beyond that. And then the third option was you could do multiple rooms. So maybe you wanted to do your spare bedroom and your basement and your attic, and you could sort of pick. And the lessons people learn were amazing. And it started with the stuff, obviously, as minimalism does. But then these really profound lessons that came through, and we wrote about them in the book. There were some people who didn't just lose their attachment to the stuff, but realized like, oh, I have a tumultuous relationship with the truth. I have an unhealthy relationship with myself. I don't know what my values are. Oh, my relationship with my money is devastating. It's ruining my relationships. It's making me miserable. Also, what about my relationship with my creativity? Because we've been told for so long that we are consumers. And that's partially true. We all need to consume some stuff. But fundamentally, we're human beings. We're creators. And we've lost touch with that. So we wanted to help people heal those relationships as well. And I think by dealing with the stuff, it really made room for those deeper questions.
Absolutely. You dive into the other relationships you mentioned: truth, self, values, money, creativity, and people. I'd love to touch on these and go a little bit deeper. Obviously, people can get their hands on your new book, but can we talk about the truth and what came out for some people when they started to remove stuff from their lives?
Yeah, man, that truth chapter was probably the hardest thing I've ever had to write. I mean, there were some things that came out with the people, with the folks, the everyday minimalists who did the packing party. But that chapter for me, the reason why it was like really powerful was because this is where Josh and I really kind of like cut ourselves open and like spilled our guts onto the page. I mean, there's some really, really embarrassing things that we had to be honest about and be truthful about. And I'll tell you, there's something that we have all over the world where like we put role models, athletes, politicians, CEOs, et cetera, we put them on this pedestal as if they should do no wrong. Once we find out something wrong that they did, there's this whole cancel culture where, people try to ruin someone's life because of something they did 5, 10, 20, however many years ago. Now, don't get me wrong. There are some things that have come out with people that certainly should be addressed. But, by and large, I think maybe you and your audience can understand what I'm saying, where there are these, kind of mistakes that people have made that they have moved past that are being brought out and they're getting canceled over. So Josh and I, we really wanted to like just show how we're not on this pedestal. We are imperfect human beings, and we've done some really embarrassing things. We've done some really bad things, and those are not, those things don't represent who we are today. We've been able to move past those, and that's what we did with Love People Use Things, is we showed how we were able to move beyond these really bad mistakes that we made. And for me, like, I think that is the story I would rather hear of someone who, maybe had a little bit of a rise, but then had this fall, but then they're able to pick themselves up, be resilient, and come out a new human being, rather than just looking at this story of someone who's on a pedestal and who is perfect. I mean, that's the hero's the hero journey archetype, right? Like, there's the rise, the fall, and then the rise again. And Josh and I, with this chapter of truth, we really just wanted to show people like we're not any different from anyone else. And I think that is going to resonate much more with people than if Josh and I just kind of talk about like we're on a pedestal talking down to people.
Definitely. I mean, there's so much more connection in reality. And what I think is interesting is that chapter is right after stuff, and it's, you've really removed the stuff. You're standing there naked. You're giving people your truth, and you're being honest about it. And I think people, I mean, you're the experts in this, but it's easy to buy things and you have this quote about the American dream and the white picket fence being the prison and keeping up with the Joneses and trying to kind of maybe use things as patchwork on top of what is truly us as a human being and our experience and what we've been through and our ability to be resilient and to be truthful. And I think it's a really beautiful first step. I didn't think that you guys were going to go there with the book, but it's really important because then you really dive into who am I, what are my values, and what are these relationships I have with things like people and money and creating. So after someone's gotten rid of their stuff and come to grips with their truth, how do they start to decide what their values are and who they are?
In the book, we have a values worksheet because what we've identified is there are four main types of values. I can walk you through them really quickly, but
I like to think
about it as a house. If you're building a house, every house needs some sort of foundation. Now, each foundation can be slightly different, but foundations tend to be foundations. And so we have foundational values: health, relationships, contribution, growth, creativity or passion. And you could probably sprinkle in a few others, but fundamentally we have similar foundations as humans. After your foundation is built, that's when you sort of put up the structure of the house. That determines what the house is going to look like, what's going to support the house. So the structural values that each of us have. Now, this is where we start to get a little bit different. This is why different houses look different. Some of it has to do with your preferences. Some of it has to do with your desires. Some of it just has to do with what you're able to build, given the life that you have been given, right? And so we all have some sort of structural values. That's where they start to vary. And then we have surface values. And your surface values, they change pretty dramatically. So you've built your foundation, right? You've got your frame in place, the structure in place. And then these surface values, they sort of beautify your home. They create the exterior, so to speak. And that facade of your home is not as critical as the structure, as the foundation, but beauty is essential. And so I think we almost take that for granted. Unfortunately, there's this fourth category, and that's the imaginary values. So I'll just walk you through a few of those first three, and then we'll get into the imaginary. We talked about the health and the contribution, so forth, for the foundation. But what kind of structural values might you have? You know, for me, I call it enoughism. What is enough in my life? Having that capacity to discern how much is enough. We never stop to even consider enough anymore. It's the more, more, more that we talked about earlier. What is enough for me, given my current circumstances? Things like autonomy and having some sort of freedom in my life. That's so much more important to me than, say, power. Now, someone else, they might, one of their structural values might be power, having dominion over other people. Okay, be honest with yourself about that. You know, I would question where that desire comes from, but if that's your desire, then you can identify that as one of your values. One of mine is mobility. You know, being unfettered by geography. I really enjoy living in California, but I don't have to be tethered here necessarily. Self-restraint is something that's really important to me. I really think the ability to avoid impulse is what real freedom is to some extent. And then our surface values, things like aesthetics and art and cleanliness and lack of clutter, design, meditation, music, reading, writing, these types of things that make life more interesting, right? Now, as your interests change, your surface values can also change a bit from year to year, month to month, et cetera. Just like if you know, sometimes you might do a whole remodel on your house and you knock a wall down. Well, your values, your surface values can change dramatically from decade to decade. Unfortunately, we've all built these giant fences around our houses called imaginary values, and there's no door on that fence. And so it keeps us from actually focusing what our values are. We say a lot of things are valuable to us. All the things I just mentioned, we can give lip service to those, but how we spend our 24 hours in a day is really what we value. So if you value busyness, if you value comfort, if you value checking email all day and productivity and public opinion, if you value social media and television and pacification, nothing immoral or wrong about those things. But let's not lie to ourselves and say, I really value my health while I'm stuck on the couch being comfortable shoving Twinkies into my mouth.
Yeah. The only thing I want to add to this about values is, you know, people ask a lot like, hey, where do I start if I want to be a minimalist? And we talked about starting with asking that question, how might your life be better with less? But the second step, I mean, even before someone starts to declutter, I think getting clear on one's values, like this is really, it's just a powerful foundation that you can build your journey of minimalism on. Because like when I look at that packing party and thinking about how I was faced with 80% of my stuff still in boxes, I just realized like, wow, like if you were to ask me, you know, pre-packing party, hey, Ryan, what are your values? I would have been like, oh, my health. You know, you got to have good health. Otherwise, you know, what kind of life can you live if you're not healthy? And then you got to have good relationships in your lives. And you got to contribute beyond yourself in a meaningful way. You got to cultivate a passion. Like I would have had given all of these values lip service, but there I was faced with all that stuff. And I realized that that's exactly what it was. Those values, I was just giving them lip service. How I spent my time was right there in front of me, purchasing, acquiring, collecting. And I just really started to appreciate that our values, it's not what we say they are, it's what we actually do.
It's so interesting to think about that in that context, because it was resonating with me that like, do you value busyness and like answering emails or, and it is, it's like we are what we're doing. It's how we're spending our 24 hours. I love Wednesdays. Today's a Wednesday, full disclosure. It's probably, I don't know if it'll come out on a Wednesday or a Friday, but like, I love learning from people like you guys. I love interviewing people for this podcast because I feel like I'm growing. It's my favorite day of the week because I get to learn and grow and be pushed to, I mean, you know what I want to do after this podcast. I want to like rally my husband and my kids and be like, okay, we're having a garage sale. Like we're looking at our values. We're deciding what's important to our family and what our time looks like. And it's interesting because you're pulled in so many different directions. You're pulled to buy something. You're pulled to answer an email. You're pulled. Like, how do you guys have boundaries and continue to practice and live this minimalistic lifestyle so that you aren't being reactive and you're being proactive to this approach to life?
You know, people often call into our podcast and they ask some version of that question with respect to boundaries. And it comes up, it manifests itself in different ways. And what I've learned is that letting go is not something you do. That sounds counterintuitive. You're like, what do you mean? I have to let go of my stuff or let go of the talk, you know, whatever it is. And and okay, I understand that. But letting go is not something you do. It's actually something you stop doing. You stop pretending that everything is precious. You stop clinging to material possessions and you stop clinging to toxic relationships, right? You stop acting like busy is a good thing. You stop posturing as if achievements make you who you are. Because if you let go of just the thing, but not the attachment, you're going to get dragged by that attachment in the future. And so instead of simply setting up boundaries, because boundaries are important, especially in our relationships, having an understanding of those boundaries is so much more important.
Yeah. You know, I wish I could sit here and say, buy our book, watch our documentaries, buy our previous, you know, three books, and you'll know exactly what you need in your life and you'll never want to buy anything again. I mean, it's not that simple, unfortunately. I mean, if I had a list of like, here are the 100 things you can have, Kelly, and here are the additional 100 things your husband can have and you have a kid. So now here, you know, it just, unfortunately, there isn't a list like that. It is something that we have to cultivate. And that's really what Josh and I have been doing and talking about for the last decade is we've talked about cultivating really healthy relationships, a really healthy relationship with our stuff. Yes, with our friends and family. But yeah, I just want to reiterate, like me as one of the minimalists, I still want to buy stuff all the time. That new iPhone comes out and I'm like, man, that sure is shiny. And man, when you get that box and you open it up and you take the plastic off, I mean, that's like an experience in itself. And I start to think about that, but because of these boundaries that we've set up, because of what we've been doing over the last decade, I can catch myself in those impulses and make a more informed decision. So, you know, how do you keep a minimalist lifestyle? You constantly just call into question the impulses that you have, and you do this in a healthy way. And if you can catch those impulses, then a lot of the times you can stop yourself from making a bad decision. Those six questions you brought up about buying something, I mean, that's one way to catch an impulse. Looking at something as a just-in-case rule, that's catching myself in an impulse. So it's really important to just build that muscle. I mean, I think the biggest thing that I've gotten out of this whole journey is I have developed this superpower of being willing to walk away from anything. And that's not just my stuff. I mean, that's also the people in my life. It's the business that Josh and I have. I mean, I intentionally every day am reevaluating, like, is there anything I need to walk away from in my life? And if so, I'm prepared to do that.
God, that's real freedom, man. Because the opposite is what? Sticking around out of pious obligation, mm-hmm. right? Oh, in the book, we talk about 13 overrated virtues. One of them is loyalty, because we think of loyalty as this grandiose good thing. Nothing wrong with loyalty. I understand the impulse to be loyal, but at what cost, right? If I find out that Ryan killed my wife, but I got to stick it out because I'm loyal to Ryan. It's like, well, no, I'm not. I mean, I'd help him hide most bodies, but not that one. now here's the thing that Ryan brought up here is that constant questioning. Minimalism is not the destination. And that's a common misconception for people, right? They think minimalism is the point. I'm going to get there. But that's like a carpenter thinking the point of carpentry is a hammer. Oh, I bought the hammer and now I've done what I need to do. Oh, no. The hammer is simply the tool that allows us to do what we want to do. Minimalism is not the destination. It is the path to get where we're going.
Absolutely. I think Ryan also hit the nail on the head that it's a muscle. Like you mentioned, Josh, that it's a journey, not a destination. Like that's kind of how it feels for me, because it doesn't ever feel like you're done, right? Like I have moved how many times during this pandemic, and every time we're donating, purging, deciding. And I, like that box of cords, it took us to the second move before we were able to let that go. but I mean, that is what it is. It's just this, it's this practice. And it seems like if you practice with your stuff, what you're saying is that we're going to get better at doing it with people, relationships, attachment to who, like jobs and who we think we are. I mean, there's so much meat in this book, but can we touch on money and how living a minimalistic life can really support your relationship with your finances?
Ryan and I grew up really poor. We thought the key to our contentment was making $50,000 a year. We wrote about this in the book, and this is late 90s. So, we take that for what it's worth. We were also in Dayton, Ohio. So take that for what it's worth. And $50,000, still really good living, especially in Dayton, Ohio. But, by age 19, I was making 50 grand. I was like, well, wait a minute. This isn't happiness. You know what? I forgot to adjust for inflation. So maybe it's 75,000. Maybe it's 90,000. Maybe it's six figures. Maybe it's owning a ton of stuff. Maybe that's happiness. Of course, that didn't work. And by my late 20s, I was the director of operations. I was in charge of 150 retail stores, which I know is really ironic as a minimalist, the whole minimalism and retail thing. But I made really good money. I made about $200,000 a year in the corporate world, which is phenomenal, especially in Dayton, Ohio. And yet I was broke. I had heaps of debt. Well, why is that? Because I made good money, but I spent even better money. And it's funny that I remember the year I walked away from the corporate world in 2011, I took a 90% pay cut. I made about $23,000 that year. And here's the irony. I was more financially secure that year than I had been any year in the previous decade. Now, why is that? Well, money isn't everything, but it's also not nothing, right? As a minimalist, I'm not opposed to having money, but I am opposed to having money problems. And so I'm not telling anyone how to live their life. In the book, what we try to do is sort of expose some of our own financial mistakes, our lousy decisions, and helping people learn from some of our blunders, because God, we made a lot of them. And I tend to avoid sweeping one size fits all solutions for people. But when it comes to money, I think money is a rather mechanical thing. And so that one chapter in the book, the relationship with money chapter, there are some sort of universal prescriptions in there that I think help from a mechanical standpoint, as long as we understand the why first. So yeah, we talk about things like budgeting and emergency funds and getting out of debt and how there's no such thing as good debt. But also we talk about using additional resources to contribute beyond ourselves in a meaningful way. It's been really important for me and Ryan and a lot of the philanthropic work that we've been able to do over the last decade or so. We built a grocery co-op in our hometown of Dayton with some of the money, the extra money that we've had, being able to contribute beyond ourselves. And well, why is that? Well, Dayton has one of the largest food deserts in the country. How wild is that? The entire west side of Dayton didn't have a single grocery store, and it houses almost 40% of the population of the entire city. One of the 65 largest metros in the country doesn't have a grocery store for half the people almost. How wild is that? Well, we were able to change that. We're able to do other things with our money now, that we're being more responsible with it. And we're not racking up any debt. We're not making unreasonable purchases. By the way, if I have to put something on a credit card, it's an unreasonable purchase. And also in there, we talk about teaching our kids about saving and giving when they're young, so they don't make some of the same mistakes that Ryan and I made. Because that was the thing. Like, money is just an amplifier. And the reason we didn't do a great job with money in our 20s is because we just continued the same crappy habits from our childhoods. And the money simply amplified those habits. It's not going to solve all your problems just by getting more money. In fact, it might amplify them if we're not careful.
Yeah, it's more money, more problems.
Amen.
So if it isn't things that really brings meaning to life, which you've highlighted throughout this book. And I think as people have moved through the pandemic and simplified their life and tried to live a more minimalistic, or maybe just organized, and maybe they're on the verge of becoming minimalistic, what do you want listeners to know is like the meaning of life and what they should be searching for and developing to really feel fulfilled?
Searching, man. It's funny because I know what you mean by that, but I'm wondering if I should encourage anyone to search for anything, because searching in a way is a chase, and a lot of chases end they end poorly. Like I think about the pursuit of happiness. You know, before this whole journey into minimalism, I was really, really adamant about pursuing happiness. And arguably, I would get that every once in a while. You know, I'd get a new car and a burst of happiness. I'd get a new home, I'd go on a vacation, boom, a burst of happiness or excitement. And the problem with that is, you know, happiness, the way I look at it now, is very much ephemeral. It's impossible for someone to be happy 100% of the time, to wake up in the morning, get out of bed, you know, get on their unicorn and ride to work on a rainbow road. I mean, that's manic is what that is. And, you know, the most manic people, they're out in the street directing traffic. So, you know, happiness is something that is certainly, we're not against that, but the pursuit of happiness is really what I'm trying to kind of maybe challenge here. I mean, what I kind of look at it, the way I look at life now is more about, how can I live a meaningful life? And the thing, when we live a meaningful life, happiness and joy and excitement, all of those things are a beautiful byproduct of living a meaningful life. And the way you live a meaningful life is your short-term actions align with those values, those long-term values. It aligns with your beliefs. When we're doing that, we're certainly still going to hit bumps in the road. We're going to have, you know, these down moments, these up moments. But if you can look in the mirror and really be honest with yourself, be like, wow, like I really am doing everything I can in alignment with my values, it does create a meaningful life. And the one thing I'll say too is, you know, without the valleys, it's impossible to have the peaks. So, you know, when life throws us these down times, it's something that personally I've learned to really not take for granted in a way. Don't get me wrong. It's not that I'm like a glutton for misery or anything, but you know, there are these moments, maybe I'm feeling sad about something and I can take a step back and be like, you know, the fact that I even have the ability to experience this emotion, that's a pretty lucky thing. And maybe just reframing it in a certain way, but I was only able to get there through living a meaningful life.
There's so much gratitude in those happy moments when we've experienced like the pain, the sadness, the grief. Mm. It makes those meaningful, joyous moments, it just like brings so much gratitude with them, which I think, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. You can't have a 24/7 unicorn, riding a unicorn on a rainbow road type of a life, and your things are definitely not going to get you there either.
Yeah.
It all depends on what you're seeking. You know, many of us say we want peace or freedom, but all of our actions, as Ryan talked about, they don't align with that value. We say we want peace, but then we embed ourselves in chaos throughout our days. We say yes to everything. And when we say yes to everything, then we're inadvertently saying no to our own tranquility in a way. I love what Ryan said about the pursuit of happiness. It's fascinating. It's almost like trying to capture a wave. I've done this with my daughter before we go to the beach, and I'll tell her, let me get your bucket before we go. I'll go get a wave for you and we'll bring it home. And she's smart enough to know that, oh, there's no wave in here. And yet, for most of my adult life, I was not smart enough to realize that I couldn't capture the wave, that wave of happiness. Oh, if I could just get my hands around this, if I could just put it in a bucket. Yeah, you do that with happiness. It's not a wave anymore. It's just a bunch of stagnant, dirty water.
Mm. I love it. It's teaching your daughter the power of presence.
Yes. Yeah. But not prescriptively, right? Yeah, it's weird. We do that in her school. Does they have 15 minutes of mindfulness a day, which really just tells me that for 6 hours and 45 minutes, they take her out of the present moment. They teach her a bunch of facts and figures, and I don't know. It's in a way, it's being taught by society. It's almost like being taught by. It's like learning how to live at a nightclub or something.
I love it. Well, you guys have obviously created so much value for people in understanding what minimalism is, how to live a minimalistic life, tools to evaluating all the relationships that they have with themselves, with their money, with their passions, creativity, their stuff. What advice would you want to leave the audience in regards to living a minimalistic life and what is essential?
If there's one message that anyone listening to this could leave with, it would be this: love people and use things, because the opposite never works.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Josh and Ryan. This was awesome. And like I said, I'm really tempted to cancel my next podcast, run downstairs and rally my husband to spontaneously combust everything in our rental home.
I'm sorry, or you're welcome. I don't know which.
No, it's good. It's like, it is, I think people get these surges of, oh, I want to do that. The pandemic was one of those pressure cookers where it was like this surge to get rid of things and to live more simply and to not be drowning in their stuff. And anytime it comes up, and I know it's going to come up for everyone listening to this podcast, is like, okay, how do I do this? How do I pull back the layers so I can have deeper relationships with myself and my family and my passions? And that is like, that's what life's about. It's like living in your passion with the people that you love and experiencing those emotions along the way instead of masking them with things.
Amen.
Oh, you guys are the best. Where can people follow along? Where can they find the book? Well, how can we learn to become minimalists ourselves?
You can find everything at theminimalists.com. There's even a game that we put together for people who really want to start decluttering. It's called the 30-Day Minimalism Game. So real quickly, what you do is you find a friend or family member or a coworker who wants to simplify. You both agree to start on the first day of any month, and you agree to get rid of one thing. And then on the second day of the month, you both agree to get rid of two things. And then on the third day of the month, three things, so forth and so on. You probably get the idea by now. It starts out real, real easy. But by like the middle of the month, by day 15, day 18, you're like, oh man, I got to get rid of 19 things tomorrow. So whoever lasts the longest wins. If both people make it to the end of the month, well, they both won because they would have gotten rid of about 500 items. And they can find all of that over at theminimalists.com.
Ooh, that's where I'm headed next. Thanks. Thanks, guys. This is so awesome. I appreciate your time.
We appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Be Well by Kelly. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at bewellbykelly.com and follow me on Instagram at bewellbykelly. I would love if you picked up my books, Body Love and Body Love Every Day. They're sold on Amazon and at all major booksellers.